Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Tiefold, your host for today. Joining me in the studio is Stephen Fan.
Yep, right here.
And we got a bunch of stuff lined up for you today. We have a report on changes to the Disability Assistance Program. Another report on proposed changes to pet regulations for importing exotic pets and looking after them, and some of the changes we'll be seeing about that. We have a report on the Vision Zero effort in New Westminster to bring traffic deaths down to zero on our public streets and roads.
I don't know. Maybe we can talk about stuff that's happening in the world at large. There must be something.
Well, there definitely is. In Burnaby this weekend, the city of Burnaby made a long-planned public apology to the Chinese community within its borders. This apology has been 2 years in the making with a group at City Hall comprised of staff and with the support of councillors has been doing a public outreach campaign to talk about the history of discriminatory policies and laws within Burnaby and talking to community members, but also doing research, talking to historians, reviewing its own archives, to fully research the history of anti-Chinese actions within Burnaby, but also by the city of Burnaby. We talked about this here on this program a couple years ago when the process first started, and there's quite a history of anti-Chinese policies, particularly in the early part of the 20th century, the early 1900s, which is around the same time that Canada was enacting laws like the Chinese head tax, which aimed to reduce Chinese immigration to Canada by basically charging what at the time was an incredibly large fee.
I think it was like the equivalent of $20,000 of today's money, and they did actually make compensation. So that is an issue that the federal government has reached out. But it's also like, I think this is kind of a broader and very kind of fascinating web of histories and issues. So one thing I heard about on the weekend, and this is kind of doesn't really tie into like historical racism or anything like that, but like, it is kind of a relevant issue, is that the most legendary Chinese restaurant in Chinatown, Flota Seafood, it's a huge restaurant, and that's why it's been the scene of many, many big events in the Chinese community. Traditionally, there was an annual kind of Chinese New Year's kind of dinner held there. They're closing down after a very long time. And there's some concern within the community that whoever, because the building is owned by the government, actually, it's in Chinatown, whoever gets the lease after that, it won't be a institution in the Chinese community in a way. There are, I know, a lot of investors who are trying to hopefully bid on the lease and maybe replace it with something else that's of equal value in the community. But it's right now the government's kind of attitude on this is very uncertain. So it's something to talk about as well.
Right. All right. Well, Burnaby's efforts, you mentioned, of course, that The federal government in years past has made a public apology and paid some restitution with regards to the head tax and other discriminatory policies. But at a local level, Burnaby, and I think this is probably true of many other communities throughout British Columbia, passed a number of laws restricting land ownership, making businesses licenses harder to get, even, you know, going so far as to adopting proposed laws created by local chapters of the Ku Klux Klan. And yes, there were local chapters of the Ku Klux Klan in the Vancouver area at the time, and they were actively working to influence policy at the municipal level and elsewhere. Burnaby researched this history. They engaged in a pretty extensive public outreach and public communication initiative around this. And then at a special meeting on Saturday, Mayor Mark Hurley made a formal apology on behalf of the city of Burnaby to its current residents, but also to its past residents who have been affected by this. So good on Burnaby for doing that.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether there are other communities looking into doing something similar. But as I say, you know, stuff like this is, you know, you know, the main period of time between which, you know, the incidents that Burnaby was apologizing for mostly ended in 1947. Not to say that, you know, anti-Asian discrimination and racism by any means ended in 1947, but a lot of the formal acts that the municipality was doing, and, you know, because it's a long time ago, we often don't talk about these things, right? So a lot of this history gets forgotten. The laws get taken out and then, you know, communities move on and kind of forget this bit of the dark history, which is why something like what Burnaby is doing with this apology is important.
I think, so my perspective on this has always been that, you know, it's nice that people want to apologize and make recompense for past wrongs or whatever. But I think communities ultimately are living things. And, you know, communities, they breathe, you know, they live, they die. Like, it's a living organism. And one thing a couple years ago, I was reviewing this short film, this documentary actually, that was had critical acclaim at the Vancouver International Film Festival, VIFF. It's called The Chef and the Daruma. It's about a person who became a legendary sushi chef who was in the Japanese community in Vancouver. And I think if you look at the Japanese community, the Japanese Canadian community today, the Chinese community today, in some ways quite similar. I think the most important thing as a member of that community for me is vitality.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese community is very, very vital, and there's a ton of vitality. But like, you know, like nowadays when I go, like I go to all these, like, you know, community festivals. I was at the, I was at the Japanese community sort of fest at Power Street Park or whatever it is. And there's just like there's a, you know, they're trying really hard, but there's some disorder around the area,
mm-hmm.
and that's making it very, very challenging for them. But like, I just think, you know, it's instead of focusing on the past, I think it is much more promising to kind of for the government, for authorities, just to foster community vitality in general.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. I mean, it's what we're doing now and what we're doing moving forward that is most important. But I do think it is important to acknowledge past wrongs and past problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not pretend they never happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So you can find out more about the Burnaby's apology to its Chinese community on the Burnaby City of Burnaby website. Now we have a report about from our friends in at the radio station in Nanaimo, and this is about changes to the disability assistance program.
This is a CHY News update. Couples who receive disability assistance will now be able to be with the ones they love without having to worry about reduced support clawbacks. Starting December 1st of this year, couples where both members receive disability assistance will receive the same support allowance as they would if they were two single people. On Thursday, November 13th, the government of BC announced it would become the first province in the country to get rid of the spousal clawback. Currently, if two people on disability assistance enters into a relationship, their combined supports would be reduced to be less than what they receive as two single people. CHY was at the announcement when MLA for Nanaimo and Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction, Sheila Malcolmson, announced the change. Malcolm says the clawbacks have been an ongoing concern for people with disabilities, as it means people would lose financial support simply for choosing to live with somebody that they love.
We want people to have the supports that they need to live with dignity and independence, both financial supports and the supports that they have in a loving relationship.
The changes would be automatic for eligible families and no application is needed.
This will take effect with the next check issue, which is November 19. Also, couples where one partner is receiving disability assistance will also benefit from an increase in the annual earnings exemption, allowing them to keep more of the money that they earn.
Julie Black and James Chapman will be celebrating 5 years of marriage next year, after knowing each other for over 14 years. Black says this new announcement is a big deal for couples like her and her husband, who have been impacted by the clawbacks.
It was a month-to-month thing where we had to find a way to scrounge for money every month just to be able to make a living. And we both work, but it doesn't pay enough for the bills, especially with the inflation now.
She says that with the ending of the clawbacks, she can now live like a normal person without having to worry about whether or not they have enough money each month. Black says people have been advocating for this change for a while, and it is great to see that work has made such a difference.
They've been pushing for this for years since I've been married. And now that it's happening, we don't have to hide anymore. Before, we felt that we had to hide the relationship like any other relationship with diverse abilities. A lot of people feel they had to hide the relationship because the ministry would pull that money back. And now we don't have to worry about that. So that's a big deal.
The changes fulfill the commitments made by the BC NDP in their 2024 election platform and their cooperation and responsible government accord with the BC Green Party. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
This is Bird Note. Jadrew Lanham is a poet and ornithologist whose work intertwines his lived experience as a Black man in the American South and his love of wilderness. Both have taught him that joy is a source of strength.
I find my joy on daily walks around the farm or just sitting and watching some bird. And it doesn't have to be a rare bird. This past spring, I was just enthralled watching robins. It was like they were so happy that spring was here, they would just sit in little shafts of sunlight. I can see that bird. I can just see it. Just sitting there in the middle of dooryard violets. I could see its eye blink. And then it opened that yellow beak and like yawned. And it didn't move. That was just it. It was just being.
It's easy to get so caught up in the hustle and bustle of modern life that we forget how to be present, or even take for granted that we're free to choose joy.
It sounds simple, but you have to grab it, you have to grasp it, you have to keep it. But however you get it, you turn to it as your superpower. And it's what keeps you alive from moment to moment.
Hear more from Drew in season 7 of our podcast, Bring Birds Back. For Bird Note, I'm Chazzy Johnson.
A growing number of exotic pet owners across British Columbia are urging their communities to speak out against UBCM Resolution NR75, which calls on the provincial government to strengthen regulations around mobile live animal programs and the keeping and breeding of exotic species. Critics say the proposal could make owning reptiles, amphibians, and other non-traditional pets illegal, affecting responsible hobbyists, educators, and conservation programs. They worry it would also shut down mobile educational programs that connect people with animals and promote wildlife conservation. Supporters of exotic pet ownership argue that NR75 could drive responsible care underground, harming both animals and the people who care for them. While this may seem a bit niche for our northern listeners, Smithers Town Council did receive a letter from a concerned citizen, and I was able to connect with Councillor and Deputy Mayor Frank Ray about how councillors vote at UBCM and a little bit about this resolution. I'm also speaking with a passionate exotic animal rescuer who thinks that education and access to exotic animals can change people's perceptions on exotic animals.
Hi, I'm Councillor Frank Ray with the Town of Smithers.
So I reached out to you to actually speak about a resolution that I saw in a letter to council at the UBCM. But before we were recording, you were bringing me up to speed on a little bit about how there wasn't time to actually get to it. And that was almost like, it's almost like in the only 2/3 of the way in for all the resolutions. So can you talk a little bit about how maybe like debate was approached a little bit differently at UBCM?
So it's actually going to change next year. Early on in the resolutions, we had a resolution to change how we're dealing with resolutions going forward, which would mean that we should be able to get through all of the resolutions more quickly and with time for debate. So this year, the one we're talking about was NR75, no recommendation block, which is really where we really do have a debate about whether or not a certain thing is going to become UBCM policy. And so we stopped this year at NR67, and there were 125 NRs. Most years we don't get through, so I'm hoping that this change that we've made this year will give more positive results next year.
What is the change?
What we have an endorsed block, which is already UBCM policy, so we can pull resolutions out of there and debate them. But the change going forward is if it's been endorsed before and it's very similar, it's not going to be admitted for debate. It's just going to be to inform what we're already advocating for at UBCM. And then there are ones that they come up a couple of years in a row and they get voted down. If it's been voted down recently, then it doesn't get admitted again if it comes back up. So the UBCM executive is going to really parse through them, and then only ones that are really matters that we haven't considered before or aren't already things we're advocating for will get debated.
And the one that we're talking about, which is mobile live animal programs, It is a strange thing that I saw a letter written to council about. So what's your take from council about how this is applicable to Smithers, if you feel like it is at all?
When people write letters to council doesn't actually decide as a council how to vote on these matters. Every individual that goes as a delegate has their own vote. So it is really up to the conscience of the individual councillors and mayors that go to UBCM to vote on these things.
We were speaking about how NR75 is actually more like two resolutions.
They are two different asks, but because they're related, it's a therefore be it resolved and be it further resolved. And so basically it's asking them to regulate the animal programs and then also to update the controlled alien species regulation to take a little more into effect about how the animals themselves are treated and the risks of disease transmission, et cetera. So I think it's a little bit of looking at maybe updating some acts to be more not just human-centered, I think. But I forgot to mention is that the second whereas actually ask them to prohibit the import, keeping, breeding, and transport of all exotic species, which is fairly wide-ranging. So I could see where perhaps some people might have concerns with that.
Yeah, Councillor Ray, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this tonight.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks again to Smithers Town Councillor Frank Ray for speaking to me. Next is a man who is passionate about exotic animal education in the Bulkley Valley and who has been rescuing abandoned exotic animals for decades in order to bring them to classrooms for educational purposes in Smithers.
Powell Thibault, probably have over 30 years working with wildlife and reptiles, been involved in wildlife sanctuaries, rehabilitation project, vet clinic, and specifically reptile zoos.
So how did you get into this?
I'm just a boy who used to like to catch animals as a kid. Crayfish, frogs, turtles, snakes, foxes, raccoons. Just a childhood passion that I was stuck with. Didn't ever shake it. And realized people are interested in my passion and I like to share my passion. So put together a reptile education program back in 2022, and it encompasses all facets of wildlife and exotic husbandry and biodiversity, just a medium I use to speak on wildlife in general. How to conserve it and how to properly maintain it if you're into keeping reptiles specifically.
Mm-hmm.
It ties into SD54's education curriculum with hopes to do more scholastic programs, get into schools more and hold not necessarily seminars, but educational opportunities.
Is that actually in the classroom, or how is that kind of, what are the nuts and bolts of that?
In order for me to give a quality presentation, I base my 1 hour presentation off of the curriculum for the grade, the class grade that I'm presenting to, grade 6, grade 7, JKSK 2, 3, 4, and 5. And it's generally, yeah, in the classroom.
Okay, cool. The reason that I called you was because at the UBCM, there was a resolution was brought up, and it was about stronger provincial regulation for what's called mobile live animal programs. And that includes things like the import, keeping, and breeding of exotic species. And it sounds like when I brought that up to you before we were recording, it sounds like that's something that you're familiar with. Can you bring me up to speed a little bit on what you know about it and how that's affected your experience of doing that in the province, of having live exotic animals in the province?
Absolutely. I'll start off by saying I'm not well versed in the specifics of what's happening now. I do know when I started this project, the thought of becoming an accredited zoological society within the Canadian requirement appealed to me. I did want to get to that stage. And then after further research, I realized in order to do that, it is quite costly and time consuming with no guarantee that you get your accreditation. And as more of this is like a, not my main job, it's more of a hobby. The cost versus profit, and it just didn't weigh out to be sustainable, to be quite honest. So that is why I'm still at the hobbyist level. And then, quite honestly, the reptiles are so diverse that the ones that do fall within BC's permit still fascinate my audiences. But overall, the process is rather deterring to someone like me to fulfill and actually go through with accreditation.
Yeah, what type of animals do you have?
I keep a few species of boa constrictors and a few species of lizards and a couple colubrid snakes as well.
Yeah. You mentioned it, but what is the what's typically the public perception that you get when people find this out about you, or what's typically the reactions that you get?
Oh, everyone's ecstatic. They love it. They get to see animals that generally invoke fear to people, and they see me and even my children handling these things and realizing these are intelligent, beautiful creatures on Earth, and it brings them to a different part of the world that they may have the opportunity to see one day, or they may never have the opportunity to see one day. But I'm there to allow them, their brain and their imagination, to go to that specific spot in the Amazon jungle where my boa will be hiding in the substrate or absorbing the sun or taking a soak in the river. If there's people that are a little bit hesitant, they do stand back and they do have their questions, and before long they're right in there with me and holding the animal, and their curiosities have been satisfied, and I feel fears get laid to rest as well.
What do you feel is not part of the discussion at a provincial level about a compelling reason for people like you, educated, for being able to keep these pets? What's like a compelling reason that you don't feel is being discussed, like at a provincial level?
I'm usually torn between this because I'm pro conservation, but in that being said, there needs to be proper education, not just you can't do this because we say so. There needs to be a reason. There needs to be explanation. There needs to be the trust that there is people quite like myself who aren't doing this like for propagation. I'm like quite often do this for no money whatsoever because I'm passionate about, again, showing people parts of the world they don't really get to see through my reptiles. I'm also passionate about speaking up for the wildlife that's misunderstood. And then in an economy, this is the other side of it, that we need jobs. There's a lot of people that could do this and make some money and help grow our economy. And then the other side of that is there's a lot of people that would abuse it. And in the 80s and the late 70s, when herpetology started to become more popular and people wanted to have bearded dragons and tortoises and iguanas, those early generations were all removed from the wild. And now the laws have been put in place where there's harder import and export laws on countries and continent. So what we have now, we really have to diversify that. But then like puppy mills, it's just mass production and people are just grabbing these things. And that's where I step in and give most of these reptiles that aren't wanted anymore forever homes. And then in doing so, I've created a program. So there's benefits, and I'm also teaching people, just like I'm talking now, like the pros and cons to everything. It's a coin. Everything has two sides to it.
Are most of your animals rescues?
Yeah, they are, actually. There is obviously a couple that I have that I purchased when I was a young teenager, and that were the most staples of my life as a teenager, and really opened my eyes to husbandry and long-term care for reptiles. And then I realize I don't need to go out and search after reptiles all the time when there's thousands upon thousands that need to be re-owned.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for taking the time to shed light and your perspective on this issue, which, to be honest, I didn't realize had such a history and was so contentious as well. So thanks so much for that.
Of course, it's my pleasure. Absolutely.
Thank you to Kyle Thibault, who runs River Reptiles out of Smithers, and Councillor Frank Ray for speaking to me today about exotic animals in the Bulkley Valley.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
And thanks to our colleagues in at CICK Radio in Smithers in Northern BC for that report.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe